Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, the 6th of 1998. In the fireside room this morning is Dorte Sola. Today's session number is 98.7, and it's titled Still With Thee. Let's listen in.
One more word about this was something which I dealt with last week, but maybe also not so self-understood. I think that any living religion needs three different elements. And one is the institutional element. We need an institution, a house, a church, bells ringing, songbooks written, the Bible, pastors, lay people, and all of that. And it's called in Christianity the patronic. The institution, the patronic element of all religions. And you find it in all religions. And some rituals, some places, some spaces are given, and there's a constructive sense in that. The second element is the intellectual clarity. And it means to do away with contradictions, to help us to understand better what the meaning is. This is what theology does all the time, to try to make us understand what's going on. And for that, in our tradition, Paul stands. It's a polemic element. But there is this third element which is often forgotten, especially in Protestantism, which is mysticism, and meaning the love for God, the love to God. We talk a lot about how much God loves us and protects us and shields us and saves us. But I think love is always neutral. True love cannot be only one-sided love. And so when we do not love God, God may love us as much as he wishes, but it doesn't work. Nothing comes out of it, and we really need to learn to love God, or even to protect God in our world. And I found through my occupation with mysticism and resistance, which is actually my life's work, which I have finished up last year in a book, which will come out hopefully next year in English, under the title Mysticism and Resistance. It has another title too, which is a name of God. And I found this in an anonymous letter of a medieval person, maybe a pastoral person trying to consolate a helpless young other person. We don't know. And the name he or she gives to God in this letter is Thou Silent Cry. And living in a world with so many loud cries, I think it's a wonderful word to think about, an image for God or a metaphor or what we call God, that we hear those silent cries of the secret of life, which we call God. And I think some of it is in this wonderful song, which was composed by Felix Mendelssohn Bartholdy. He comes from a Jewish family which had a big name in the 18th century in Germany in philosophy. Moses Mendelssohn was a great philosopher. He stems from this family, and he was a Christian and worked quite a bit in sacred music and has done some very good things. Now, I just learned from our friend Jairo, who's today with us, that this is a song without words, which is a collection of pieces for the piano, and someone must have brought these two together. I didn't know that until today. I just learned it from him. I had found this in a Presbyterian songbook, this hymn, and loved it from the very beginning. And I think I would like to introduce you, with the help of this music and this hymn and our singing, into some of what we call natural mysticism, the experience of oneness in nature. But let's first go and sing. I used here, there were only four verses, so if you skip the fourth in your paper and then go from 3 to 5,
that would be helpful in terms of places to experience the oneness with God, eroticism being one, suffering being one, community, joy. There are many, I mean, there are more than I can mention.
music is surely one of the great locations where we feel this and experience this. But nature is really something which is in so many places witnessed to as something where I feel God. I don't mean that people, at least in my culture in Germany, often tell me, oh, I don't need a church. I go to the woods and there I find God. I think this is superficial nonsense. But it is because you have to get into a language for God and not forget this language. And that's a danger which I see in a post-religious culture which we are entering, and which gives up on all this language and these talks and these prayers and this Bible and this reading and all of that. And I think we need to be educated in this, or alphabetized into this language in a way, and because it helps us then to understand our own experiences better. And this is a mutual give and take as well, from the tradition to our lives, and from our lives going back to the tradition, going backward and forward. And I think this romantic song is a typical 19th century bourgeois woman who has written this song. Comes from a hymnal. This is a simple expression of mystical natural piety. Its author is Harriet Beecher Stowe, 1811 through 1896. She wrote magazine stories that were considered sentimental, and finally wrote the renowned novel Uncle Tom's Cabin in 1851. Stowe initially wrote it as a series for widely read magazine, National Era, the mouthpiece for those opposed to slavery. Her novel was received enthusiastically far beyond abolitionist circles. It became a cult book of resistance. As can be seen by the statement attributed to Abraham Lincoln, it's not quite clear whether he said this ever or not. So this is the little lady who made this big war. Mm-hmm. He saw her finally. It is astonishing how highly Stowe's European contemporaries esteem the literary and moral qualities of a book that generally is viewed today as too shrill and even sentimental. In the 19th century, it was characterized as the most valuable American contribution to English literature. Tolstoy equated it with Dickens' Tale of Two Cities, and Heinrich Heine, this German Jewish poet, even equated it to the Bible. The mystical morning song does not speak of the realities of slave trading, humiliation, and torture. It lives entirely out of the bourgeois piety of white women who sing of the thou God experience in nature. God and the soul is a theme. The I alone with thee, still, still with thee, as it repeats again and again in this song. The soul is alone with its God. The dawn mirrors its unity, which in an entirely traditional manner is fairer and lovelier than the manifestations of nature. That's a traditional topos, we say in literature. Is this a common word in English? I don't know. It's something which is often used. Fairest Lord Jesus, maybe some of you know this beautiful song, comes also from Germany. Fairer, fair is the moon, fairer are you, fair is the sun, you are fairer. So it uses a language which names one thing to transcend the thing and said this is more but it doesn't name the second one, which is more, by its own name, because there is no name for God. And this is, we call this the absolute comparative, which transcends the fairness of the morn, the fairness of the moon, of the sun, and goes into something which is more without being able to name it. And this is a figure which you can find very often in mystical literature. I think we understand this song better when we sing it with Mendelssohn. Singing helps to understand the text better. The shadows are called mystic here in the second verse. And the adoration is breathless. And the awareness of unity with God is sweet. That's also a very old word. It's still much more at home here in this part of the world than it is in our part, where it's more or less just for over-sugared things. And not so much has this deep sense it used to have in the medieval German. It has the same sense it still has sometimes here, but you would call a person sweetie or something like that. And it's used here in this old sense. It was one of the favorite words of the women's mystics of the Middle Ages. They used again and again the name to be sweet Lord Jesus. And the word still plays a central role as also. And that goes back to the Bible, this word. It is connected to the ability on the mystical way to let go. I'll come into that on Saturday morning a little bit more, what that means in mystical sense. To become still means to become free of worries and desires, both sorrows and desires. It is more than the mere absence of noise, it's something else. The New Testament relates how Jesus stands in the storm and bids the wind to be still, so that a great silence, the Greek for that is silence of the sea in Mark 8:26, is given. It's called galene, and it plays a role in many of poetical, romantic poems. I'm here thinking out of my own tradition. There's a beautiful song by Schubert, Thou art the stillness, thou art the peace, du bist die Ruhe, der Friede mild. Maybe some of you know that. It's beautiful music. The longing you and what it stills. That's all you. I'll try to translate this. This experienced peace always signifies two things in the mystical tradition. God's invitation to enter the stillness, to become still ourselves, to let go the desires, the worries, the sorrows. And at the same time, the transfer of life, the giving of oneself to God. That is what stillness means. It goes back to this word galene in Greek, which means the stillness of the sea. And it becomes even without any troubled waters. I was thinking, I went to Holden Lake the other day, since I'm here, and I was thinking that there was the slightest thing which would disturb the stillness was visible, and was something you would notice and you would go with. And when it was still again, you noticed that. It was wonderful. I'd like to say a few words more about the fourth in my version, the last verse. So shall it be light, and that bright morning the soul waketh, and life's shadows flee. Oh, in that hour, fairer than daylight dawning, shall rise the glory thought, I am with thee. Now, in Christian tradition, early morning in the monastic tradition, or the medieval tradition, was the time to regard one's own death. And that's the background of this verse. To understand it in contemplation as an awakening to true life. That's behind these words here. Last in that bright morning when the soul waketh, dying is seen as a form of awakening. And life's shadows are the shadows of this life in which slavery, war, diseases, hunger, rule. Earthly life is seen as night and shadow, life's shadows, which disappear in the eternal dawn. That's an expression from another romantic poet. The eternal dawn, which finally will come and open up. It's also going back to the musical traditions in one of Schumann's songs, a beautiful song which is, the poet is Eichendorff, and he talks about this eternal dawn that comes in the morning. It's also an evening song which ends then with the eternal dawn of the morning. The mysticism of nature and its stillness merge with the mysticism of the hour of death. Now, let me go back a little bit to the author. Mary Beecher Stowe was a woman who embodied the unity of what mysticism and resistance can mean. Born by the abolitionist civil rights movement, she was also born to this inner stillness, which filled her hero, Uncle Tom, with a humility that is hard to bear today. It's criticized sharply today for good political reasons, because he refuses to be used as a whip. Cassie is another slave. He's beaten to death. That's his story. Yet I think this does not diminish Stowe's historic achievement in having shaped the resistance against the criminal system of slavery, particularly since in the book itself she portrays another option for black people. Before being sold in the South, the household slave Elisa flees with her son to freedom. So Uncle Tom is not the only image of who the black person is. And the black movement has criticized this very sharply during the 60s. I recall that this great black writer, what's his name again, James Baldwin, has critiqued the Uncle Tom's mentality very sharply, and said this is not what black people should find their identity. I think he was absolutely right with that, because it is an identity. And when you take out just the Uncle Tom piety out of the book and forget about all the other things which are in the book, you don't understand what black identity means. And I think Harriet Beecher Stowe in herself, in her own life, daring to be a pastor's wife and more or less not too well-known woman who wrote stories and novels, to stand up in this clear form against slavery is wonderful and is not, I mean, surely she spoke to white people, basically, and with good right, because they were the ones who caused the whole problem. So she had to speak to them, to their people. It wasn't her business to speak to black people, but I think it was a great achievement how coming out of mystical religiosity and a mystical sense of our being one with God. Resistance grows, and the testing of the system and the making known what the system does to its victims and how these victims are used and what purposes. And I sometimes dream we would have a sort of a writer who would talk about the neoliberal system and its slaves in the same way, in the same very day-to-day-like way, understandable enough. We have great literature which talks about black people's pain and other people's pain, but still there is something we need more in the way of Harriet Beecher Stowe. I think I've reflected a bit upon the word sentimental, which is, has been so much used. Thank you. We sing it another time without you. Because, and I have some good, I think there are some good reasons to talk about sentimentality and to be aware of the dangers of sentimentality. Being a German, I'm really very aware of that. I know very well that some of these people in Auschwitz, coming home from gassing children, loved Beethoven. For me, it's incredible, but it is true. They listened to that music. They played themselves. So this is the sentimental love, which. By that I mean sentimentality is to take a little garden of your life and make it into a nice place. And there you have warm feelings. And there you are a humanistic being. And there you think about God. And there you pray or do whatever. But it has nothing to do with the other bigger part of your life, which is then called business or job or duty. Or fatherland, or whatever. And I think that makes our feelings sentimental, to limit them to a small little garden in our lives. And that is what sentimentality means, and I hate it. I think it's so terrible, because it destroys not only other people, because it blinds us and doesn't tell us the truth, but it destroys even our feelings in making them smaller than they are. And mysticism, in a way, makes us grow. It makes our feelings grow more, make them wider, make them inclusive, make them for everyone. There's a wonderful poem of a man I mentioned yesterday, Thich Nhat Hanh, this Buddhist writer, monk, and resistor during the Vietnam War. And the title is Call Me By My True Name. And then he starts out to tell us all the names which he calls are his true names. It starts with the fly that slowly, slowly goes up his glass. My true name is this fly. And then he goes on to many, many nature names, and then he goes on to boat people who flee from his home country, Vietnam. And goes then on, there's a young girl who commits suicide and springs into the ocean because she has been raped by the captain of the ship. And then he says, the young girl's name, that's my name. The man who rapes her, that's my name. So he goes on and on to be inclusive, step by step, and telling they are all of them are my brothers, my sisters, my co-creatures. they are, this is my name. My true name is not ego or individual or personal. And I think this is one of the greatest dangers of our time, to become so much over-individualized that we don't see these other names we need and which are giving us when we open ourselves up into this oneness with God. And I think the individualization and the education for this ego tripping is one of the strongest media for our economy, to make us so dependent and so consumerist and so crazy and so blind. And I think if we are not, will not become free from the ego, and Thich Nhat Hanh is a wonderful teacher of that, we'll never be free for this stillness we need. So I would like to sing this once more. Is there anyone who would like to play the piano? Just play it once through and then we come in. Maybe stand there up. Seems better. Thank you. you for seeing, listening, share whatever you wish to share.
Yeah, I had a thought on your discussion of Harriet Beecher Stowe that I agree the mysticism somehow leads you into resistance. But I think when you let go of your ego, which is kind of your last comment there, and let that mysticism guide resistance, I think it just builds on itself. I suspect, you know, God had a hand in the publication of Uncle Tom's Cabin, and it's why it somehow was the thing that was needed. And she was able to do that which was needed.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think she did it out of an ego place. I think she just had to let it and the connections unfold. And, you know, it's that kind of serendipity. I think in all resistance movements, the people who act in tribute to God.
I didn't quite his last
in most resistance movements, people attribute the success in resistance to God. Because they don't think they could have logically planned, and I mean you have to logically plan what you can plan, but at some point it hopefully spirals upward rather than downward.
Yeah.
So I think it's
That's very true, I think. Many friends in the left wing movement in Germany who, after 89, in a way, felt absolutely homeless and felt that they were not Stalinists, never. But they were so shocked by this the final victory of this economy, and it was an economic victory, and that they didn't know where to go. And we as Christians sometimes consoled them and said, "Oh, listen, you know, we know this since 2,000 years. We had a guy who was called Jesus, and he told us how to live." And then the church came and made Inquisition and burned witches and hated women and terrible things and blessed wars and the heroes and all of that stuff. And of course we hated it and tried to resist. But it was our church as well as it is your party, which was Stalinist and did all these terrible things. So don't worry. The thing you had in mind won't die. The people are equal. All have a right to eat and to go to work and to go to school and all of these human rights, which are our cause, and that will die. But they, without a religious something, I don't know how to tell it, I think there's a lot of people who just sink again into privatization, cynicism, fun-making. It's terrible. This is at least one of my experiences. And I enjoy your phrase, what you just said, that in all resistance movements there is a religious motivation, or a religious form. I think I have seen a bit of that in some places in my country. Had a very strong resistance movement against the transporting of nuclear waste. And 10,000s of young people go to the places where this nuclear waste is brought to, because it's absolutely unsafe. Everyone knows that. There is no way to storage nuclear waste. Science doesn't tell us what to do with the consequences of what they have invented. Everyone knows that, but only these many, many thousands of young people go and blockade the places where it should be stored. And most of these young people are kids, haven't seen a church from the inside since 10 years or so. And pastors go also, and they go with their black gowns, smooth-on gowns, which is good for TV, just so that people see who speaks there. And they also have small units of contemplative prayer, or simply of silence, standing together with a circle of, say, 20 or 50 people, read a story, pray a prayer, keep silence, sing a song. And more of these young people come, because they have this hunger for some motivation beyond the one they know. And so I talk too much.
I'm gonna make a comment and ask for some clarification. I'm not sure I can articulate it. In my studies in 19th century literature, one of the languages that women could access was the language of sentimentality.
Yeah.
And I'm really interested in the connections, but also the distinction from mysticism that you were making in your previous comment. In the 19th century, there was so much prohibition against women speaking, particularly in religious organizations, that they had to access the more sentimental forms, like hymn writing, stories, narratives, novels, like Uncle Tom's Cabin. And yet, there was this strong feeling in the 19th century that you could move people to change, to resistance, through sentiment, through emotional rhetoric, in a way that you couldn't always through the authoritative language of the government or the church. And I was thinking about your example of the Germans listening to Beethoven, that there would be a way in which these women who were writing, you know, Harriet Beecher Stowe, Elizabeth Gaskell, George Eliot, some of those writers, would think, if I can move these people from this perspective, then we can start the resistance through which this social reform can move. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about both your disdain for sentimentality that you were articulating, but also I think you were saying that there's a kind of resistance that comes through mysticism. Are you making a connection between sentiment and mysticism, or are you saying that they're different?
Thank you for your comment. That's really very good. There is a linguistic distinction, I think, which in the 18th century, the word sentimental meant really emotional. Sentimental journey was not someone weeping all the day or something, which we would maybe call it sentimental. And the word has gone down, at least in German language. Is really now a nasty word. More, don't be sentimental means don't be self-pitying or something. Don't be so self-occupied with your own little headache or whatever. And it has lost this old sense, which in Goethe times still had, this old good sense, which was simply over against rational, there was sentimental, there was the language of the heart, the language of feeling, the language of emotions. And I couldn't agree more with you when you said that women were allowed only very special places in the same is true for the whole history of theology, of Christian theology. Women had no space, no allowance to sacred power from the very beginning, or from an early time, not the very beginning, but the construction of the church in its hierarchical form. And therefore, women were looking for other places. And most women went into mystical experiences and honored those experiences, talked about it, developed a language on it. And when in the late medieval time, there was a strong women's movement in Europe, the Beguines. This was a group of women who were not not happy with the ways of life which were open to them. And one was marriage, which meant to be given to an unknown man by your parents and to have to give birth every year. And then you die in the 12th or the 15th birth you gave. That was normal. That was the life expectation for women. And you had no say whatsoever about your own life. You had no, there was no way to deny these consequences of birth. This was the legal right of the husband, whether the women wanted it or not. So there was an alternative, that was the convent, but that was very often very costly because they wanted to have a dowry before they ended. So it was more or less for feudal, superfluous women to go there, which couldn't be married out of some reasons, and then they sent them into a convent. And that was the reality of women, and there was a coming out of a new spirit and a new thirst for education. That was one of the big themes of their time. They wanted to learn to read. And if they were not allowed to read Latin, they were at least to wanted to read and to speak and to write in their own languages, such as Flemish or German or French or whatever. And they developed a mystical culture of prayer, of visions and auditions, which finally was so powerful that the official church had to open some space to it. And this comes out very well in the definition of mysticism which scholasticism has given to us. And it is, it says, cognition of God through experience. Cognitio Dei experimentalis. That's the Latin word. And it tells us there is cognition of God in many ways, through the sacrament, through the Bible, through the preacher, and through all these patronic forms of the Christian religion. But aside from that, there's also some space which is open for those who experience God in the freshness of the morn or any other place. So it was a giving in to the women's movement. You have to read this, it sounds very abstract, this three-wordish definition, but it's an excellent definition, really, because it allows for women to bring in their own experience. I mean, and men as well, lay people, as such, could it opened up something which was before not defined as clearly. We are all able to experience God even outside of church, sacrament, Bible, and so on. And when I mentioned in the beginning my harsh criticism of those people in my culture who sometimes tell me that they rather go to the woods instead of going to the church, it's not that I don't think they would find God, but I don't believe them when they say so. Because when you have this need for, you know, this thirst for God, or this real love for God, this passion for God, then you are not satisfied with your own self and nature. You need to express this somehow. And I think I'm sort of skeptical, at least with some of these people, maybe.
Something I sort of noticed through everyone's, well, through your talking and yours, like, we use a lot of examples of people protesting or
or like maybe an oppressed group. And it seems like a lot more of the oppressed people get into mysticism more. Like the Jewish children did art and sang songs in the camps. Mm-hmm. And the women were like in our country, like, or people protesting against the nuclear transportation were praying or doing that. And for some reason, it's easier for me to imagine more of the oppressed people having a stronger faith in God. But I don't know, it's sort of a really big generalization, but.
Yeah. I mean, this is the theology of the oppressed, which is called theology of liberation. They have a phrase saying, the poor are the teacher. In other words, these poor, uneducated, no book knowledge people teach me something about God which I, who am highly learned, cannot know. And that's great. He puts the whole thing upside down. The least become the first. Yes, amen. That's true. Mm-hmm. And it's not we who would be the leaders. Although I do think God needs us as well to free God's people from our oppression. And I think I've also the experience that the small groups of the cells of resistance, as I always call them, in our countries, are very much, there are many women in that. I was thinking when you spoke just about the Green and Common women in Great Britain, the ones who went to the places where the nuclear weapons were put into earth, and they would hang on the wire which was surrounding these places. There was a woman who helps another woman to give birth, how do you call that?
Midwife.
The midwife who brought her testimony about her occupation and what she had learned and hang it up there because she wants to give life to life and not nuclear death. And I love that story always, that she would hang up this part of her life to tell the world, this is what we need, and not what they bring in here. And in that sense, I think that we have to learn from all our brothers and sisters in resistance and find out new ways. And I learned quite a number of things, really, from this country, especially with this form we talked the other night about the boycott as one possibility of resistance. This is something which I only learned in the United States of America, where they may be economically a little smarter than we who still lived in a more or less social democratic order, where people don't fall immediately on the street and having nothing. I mean, there's still some taken care of by the government. But and I learned a lot about new forms of resistance we need. To give you an example, which is also from this nuclear trash and the nuclear buildup of atomic power plants. The firm which is behind that is Siemens, which is a multinational corporation in Germany, Siemens produces these elements which are needed to have a nuclear power plant. And I went to a place in northern Germany, close to Holland, a very Catholic, rural place. many people were shocked about that they now would be become the new power waste, nuclear power waste place. And they didn't know what would happen, and they were afraid all these young chaotic people would come in and do their resistance, and what would they do, the people who lived there? They were afraid. And I tried to convince them that there are many forms of resistance. You can blockade sitting there on the trains, things. But you can also write a postcard to Mr. Siemens and tell him, your refrigerator is wonderful, it's ecologically sound, it's great. But you know, I have children, or I have grandchildren, and I don't like leukemia, and which comes when you have nuclear waste. And so I can't buy your stuff because of my children, and you are still supporting the nuclear power plants. And then I tried to explain to them, when Mr. Siemens gets 200 postcards every day on his desk, he will change. There's some realistic hope in that. And you have to push forward these things. That's at least as I understand. There are many, many things to learn. I recall when I first was in the United States, it was, I think, one of the first week, I bought some grapes for my children and my family. And a student came over and saw the grapes, looked at me and said, what? You are buying those grapes? I said, well, why not? What's that wrong with these grapes? And they explained to me César Chavez and all other things which I didn't know. I forgot the name of this firm. It was some special firm of grapes which we were, shouldn't buy, and no one in our school bought. And I was terribly ashamed because I didn't know. And I learned a lot from my students. And I think there are forms of resistance. The thing was, César Chavez has really influenced me deeply. He prayed before he called a new action, and he fasted sometimes 30 days or so. And he prayed, and then people would say, outstanders or journalists would say, oh, watch out, César Chavez is praying. He's something in his mind. He will come out with something wild, new. And I love that. And I think we have to share also our experiences with resistance, and also how it is grounded in our awareness, I am with thee. Yeah. And not only with my rational analysis, which tells me this leads to that, and this is telling me because of it implies children's working, etc., etc. I need more than that. I need something which has to do with this oneness. Yes, I think they admonished us all, the teachers, to begin and close punctually, so I will follow the rules here, because I'm not a good follower otherwise, anyway.
Thank you.
Thank you.